Hello there, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to the download of Business Daily. Not in the studio for once, but in the Business Daily office here in the BBC World Service headquarters in Bush House. Today's programme is all about the buildings people use for their offices. I'll be going up the tallest tower in Europe.
From the top, from the 72nd floor, you can probably just pick out Terminal 5 at Heathrow. Not sure how far that out is, 25, 30 miles?
And I'll be looking at new low-rise buildings too.
Access to views of nature, a forest, a garden, actually contributes to a reduction in heart rate and arguably an increase in worker productivity.
Or should we, as the BBC's done here in Bush House, reuse old buildings for modern workspaces? The truth is, people are spending more and more of their lives at work as we all toil for longer hours. So the way those working buildings function is very important. This BBC building, Bush House, was opened on July the 4th, 1923. But 88 years later, we love it, although it's eccentric and sometimes bits of it don't work. Bush House is only 8 floors high, but even so, it's actually taller than the building some point to as the earliest ever skyscraper, the Equitable Life Assurance Building, built in 1870 in New York. These days, there's fierce competition worldwide to build higher and higher. About a mile away from here, there's a great pointed tower of glass which has been climbing skywards. It's called the Shard on the south bank of the Thames across from the City of London. And when it's finished next year, it will be the highest building in Europe. It's been a long haul. When the credit crisis struck, it was rescued by an injection of money from the Middle East, from Qatar. To get a sense of the scale of it, I got in one of the many lifts with its public relations director, Baron Phillips. So now we're waiting for a lift.
Yes, currently 37, it's got a ways to go up and to come down.
I get the sense that a lot of people on this building site are waiting for lifts quite a lot of the time.
Well, there's a lot of movement continuously in the building, getting to various floors because work's going on continuously. And I think probably even as we speak now, there are somewhere in the region of 1,200 people on site.
The lift's arrived.
At last. Right, off to you. Oh, it'll get quite cosy.
No push, please. Yeah, show some love, boys. Yeah? Squeeze on.
So I've just walked out of the lift. Tell me where we are, Baron.
Well, we're on the 43rd floor where they're completing the, if you like, the fenestration, putting in the glass cladding. Three quarters, I guess, of this floor now has been fully glassed.
So can I just walk over and have a look at the bit that isn't glassed in?
Yes, of course you can.
I've been allowed to walk closer to, well, what I suppose you'd call the edge. But there is a piece of metal grille between me and the outside world, and it's actually quite windy up here. And looking down, how can I describe to you which bit of London we're seeing?
We're looking out across south-southwest London. The river is actually to our right. You can see the wheel, you can see Big Ben and the Houses of Parliament.
It is quite surreal standing here above London. Looking right across to the horizon, I can see the bumps of the hills way beyond London. How many miles can you see?
You can see from the top, from the 72nd floor, you can probably just pick out Terminal 5 at Heathrow. Not sure how far that out is, 25, 30 miles?
And it is an extraordinary view to have. I can see the trains leaving London Bridge Station. Actually, a station that I come through every single day. And they look like toy trains. They're absolutely tiny. It is like seeing London laid out like a toy railway set in front of me.
Back down from the dizzy heights to a lower floor, it was time to meet the man behind the Shard, Irvin Seller, the former market trader turned property developer who bought the land and decided to raise the existing buildings and make a landmark building for offices and for public use, a great new punctuation mark on the London skyline. He told me about how he first met its architect, Renzo Piano.
He's not a fan of tall buildings. He finds them aggressive, they're fortresses, you can't get in, they're not friendly to the public, and they're symbols of power. But then he stopped talking and looked at the images we had and saw the rail lines and saw the closeness of the river. And then he started to sketch on the back of the menu. And he sketched. He said, I see it like a giant iceberg emerging from the water, or a white sail. And I said, carry on sketching. He said, it's got to look great at low level, at mid level, and distance. And that sketch bears a remarkable resemblance to what we see today. I've still got it.
Back then, presumably, the economy, the world economy, was looking a lot better. It was a lot more buoyant. Along the way, did you think at any point that the financial crisis might derail your dream that we're standing in now?
Yeah, I mean, in any major development, and one that turned out to be as sizable as this, there are concerns and there are bumps along the road. And we've had a few. And so we've had not only construction difficulties, we've had financial crises. It's not been easy, but nothing very good is that easy.
So in the end, this is being built largely with Qatari oil money. Is that right?
Yes, largely. That is right. If it wasn't through them, this wouldn't be built, because they came in at the time in the depth of the financial crisis and effectively took over from the bank negotiations that we were having with Credit Suisse and one or two others at that time. And thank God for that. And I think London will be very pleased about this, because it's the one building where there are a number of firsts in this building. Firstly, I think we've managed to get more net lettable space on this site than perhaps anywhere in the world. On a one-acre site, we will get 22 acres of net leasable space.
Is that because it's just so tall?
Partly because of that, and because of the design and the efficiency of the design.
I'm old enough to remember...
You don't look it.
Well, I am. I'm old enough to remember going to another iconic tower in London. I'm not sure you could... Actually, you can see it from here, yeah? It's just over there to the right. Mm-hmm. The Canary Wharf Tower, when it was in crisis. It was planned in a boom and built in a recession. It was half empty when I went there, I remember, in the financial crisis then. Mm-hmm. What's going to stop that happening again?
Well, we can't control the global situation, but we feel very confident that this building will attract the right occupiers, and marketing process has already commenced. At the moment, there is, and it's well recorded, more demand than there is quality space. So we're in the right period of time to lease this space. Because of the crisis, there's been very little new construction.
That was the developer of The Shard, Irvin Seller. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC about the buildings we work in, with me, Leslie Kerwin. Well, tall buildings may be eye-catching and prestigious for corporate clients, but they have their critics, who argue they're aggressive, macho, and overexpensive. Some in the world of architecture reckon the best solution for many companies is to occupy low-rise rather than high-rise offices. So how do these work differently for the employees inside them? I've been talking to an architect who's designing one for ExxonMobil, one of the biggest energy companies on the planet, in Houston, Texas. He is John Picard of Picard Chilton. I asked him about the advantages of buildings like this.
One of the goals is to create collaboration. And it's interesting, when one is in a tall building, and Picard Chilton has designed many skyscrapers, we're very knowledgeable of those issues. But in tall buildings, people, for whatever reason, tend to rely on the elevator. And in a low-rise campus structure, people tend to walk. For instance, we, in our low-rise corporate facilities, we will design the buildings around a series of atria, and people are communicating by stairway, and we provide elements for collaboration, whether it's a coffee bar, so that people walk to it. And it makes for a very natural environment, and we think can encourage enhanced communication between employees and guests.
So do you think that using lifts or elevators actually gets between people getting together and just kind of shooting the breeze or talking to each other about work?
I think you can use lifts, and we certainly do, if you take advantage of how you bring people together in a tall building. And I believe Mr. Piano and his design for The Shard has done a terrific job of that. But we also believe in a low-rise corporate facility, that we can step away from relying on lifts. Frankly, we can reduce energy costs because the exercise of moving up and down a stair really comes for free. We can appreciate there are also some great health benefits. So there are two approaches. Neither one is right, but frankly, increasingly our corporate clients are looking to the advantages of low-rise structures to complement their business interests.
And do you think that's something that we see across the world? Is high-rise increasingly the exception rather than the rule?
It's really a question of where are you choosing to do business and the value of land. When you're in the heart of London, the Shard is an appropriate and natural resultant of those real estate factors. When you're in Texas, Oklahoma, or Iowa, you have different real estate factors that allow for a low-rise campus facility to really make a lot of business sense.
So generally speaking, does that mean that low-rise developments are cheaper than skyscrapers?
They can be. It's interesting. As one builds tall, just the act of building, the cost of that goes up and up. So for every floor you build over 40 floors, you pay an additional premium. For every floor over 50 stories, you pay an additional premium. So those construction costs typically are much lower on a low-rise campus building.
So does all this add up to the decline of the very tall building?
No, I don't believe so. I think the tall building will be an important part of our culture and the business scene forever because it does indeed solve very real business problems. And frankly, the city is an incredibly sustainable machine. And so that's really a question of what is appropriate to the context within which one is making real estate decisions.
Do you think that the low-rise is a kind of different approach to the image of a company?
Because
a tall, high-rise building is a very thrusting, aggressive thing.
Absolutely. I think you've identified something that's important and that perhaps isn't often discussed, which is, it's a quieter statement, and it creates a different environment for employees. And I would argue that that very much can be a factor that influences the strategies that corporations may use based upon how they want to present themselves to the world. And again, I will argue neither one is good or bad, they're just different.
How different do you think are the working environments if you're sitting in an office on the 40th floor or if you're sitting in a big campus low-rise building?
We've done a lot of research in the design of our corporate work, and everyone recognizes the value of natural light, and natural light can be provided in both a skyscraper and a low-rise campus. What's an interesting and relatively recent discovery is researchers have noted that access to views of nature, a forest, a garden, actually contributes to a reduction in heart rate and arguably an increase in worker productivity. Sadly, the research is not as crisp as we would all like, but it appears to be there. But on the other hand, because again, as a firm, we've designed more than our fair share of skyscrapers. There's something wonderful about being on the 40th floor and enjoying the movement of the clouds and looking over the city. They're just different.
Architect John Picard of Picard Chilton. Of course, we've been looking at brand new buildings for use as offices and workplaces, but lots of us work in buildings which are not new or purpose-built. They've been adapted. Take Bush House, where I'm standing right now. It was originally built not as a radio station, but as a World Trade Center, and at the time it was said to be the world's most expensive building. I met the architect, Professor Stephen Gage, from University College London, who's an expert in these matters, and we met in front of another building that's been in use for more than 200 years. We're standing outside a large 18th century house. Now, tell me about how this building has been adapted over the years for different uses.
This building's constructed as a house, a rather smart house at the end of the 18th century. And during the 19th century, it slowly moved in this area to becoming part educational, part medical, still largely residential. And by the end of the 19th century, this building was occupied by what was then quite an old architectural school founded in 1840. It's quite strange because the building is largely kept as it was inside. And the reason that it's so successful is, I believe, that the building contains really good, really useful rooms and has done since it was built.
So in the end, it all comes down to rooms and how useful they are. Should we go inside and have a look at them?
Yes.
So just going through this massive door, marked number 36, with a huge door knocker on it in the shape of a lion's face, and through into a very elegant corridor. So in terms of cost, can it actually make sense to adapt a building? Is it sometimes more expensive to do that?
I think it depends exactly what you're trying to do and what the building's function is going to be. If you are completely gutting a building down to a concrete frame and then starting again, it may well be, on balance, about the same in terms of cost as rebuilding the thing. But on the whole, most buildings are knocked down either because, in a commercial sense, somebody can put more building on the same site area, in other words, it's a land value argument, or they put a new building goes up because of pride, because somebody wants to show what a grand person they are, or indeed buildings are knocked down because they've failed socially, and this is what's happened in the UK in an awful lot of public housing. In fact, it's not just a UK phenomenon, it's, I think, probably international.
So what about this idea of the flexi building that you've told me has been around really since the 50s or 60s? Does it actually work?
Well, a building that you can reuse definitely works. I mean, we're standing in a building that demonstrates that. A building that you can strip out to its bones and reuse definitely works if you want to pay the money. I mean, good examples there are the really kind of splendid reuse of light industry and warehousing in New York and the New York lofts, which are phenomenal buildings. Buildings which are flexible, where you, if you like, you're kind of going to be, make, I don't know, walls disappear, toilets appear and disappear and so on, are intrinsically expensive to make. And there have been real examples of failure when things have either not worked or have been too heavy to move, or nobody's bothered to move because they've got the thing into a configuration that they like.
That was Professor Stephen Gage. Well, what do you feel about your workplace? Send us your ideas on what kind of offices work best for the workers. Are old buildings, tall buildings or low buildings your favourite? Email us at world.business@bbc.co.uk. That's it from the Business Daily office and the sirens outside and the whole team here with me.
Hey!